conquering and to conquer, which to me, there are many, many views of this. One of the things I keep pointing out is that if you read 20 commentaries on the book of Revelation, you'll probably get about 20 different things out of it. But to me, the white horse rider, which is not Christ, Christ is the one opening the seals. So Christ does not open the seal and then he comes riding out, which is a lot of them see it as Christ and some see it as the church. I believe that that white horse rider is primarily education because it is a peaceful conquering. The white horse, the fact that he's on a white horse indicates that this is not a horse of war. That doesn't come until the second horse. So I thought before I take a lot of time in that, I want to read several things to you to point out the decline in the morality of the United States of America, the morality of the world, because the world is basically, without exception, under the same educational system. Ronald Reagan was one of his great failures, and maybe this was his greatest failure, was that he entered into an agreement with Mikhail Gorbachev in which they had what they called a cultural exchange. And I'm not exactly sure what the United States sent to Russia. I think part of it was when the rock groups started going in there and they were performing, and the Russian leadership just got incensed by the immorality of those groups and they began to cut them down. But what Gorbachev sent to Reagan was the educational system that had been in use in Russia for a long time. So we had we were already dealing with the Prussian system that was brought to us by Horace Mann back in the mid-1800s. The Prussian system was 180 degrees away from the American system. So the system in America had to do with being Bible-centered, being locally controlled by the parents. Great stress was put upon the qualifications of a teacher, the moral qualifications as well as the spiritual qualifications of a teacher, and they were extremely concerned that whoever was going to take that job of teaching the child during the day would be in complete agreement with the religious convictions of the parent. When that system of Horace Mann's came in, he brought with it one of the great curses that ever was put on America, called compulsory attendance. There was no compulsory attendance from the 1600s up to the mid-1800s. If you went to school, you went to school. If you didn't, you didn't. But during that period, we had the highest level of literacy that we've ever had in America. And the great writers, the truly great writers and thinkers of that time were those who were what I call biblicists. They were Bible-centered. And their writing was very, very sound and solid. And to this day, you can go and read them and you can learn from them. Where once they brought in compulsory education, that's because they were changing the system. And they wanted to take these children now under force of law and compel them to be changed from a biblical mind to a pagan or corrupt mind, taking them to the reprobate mind. There is this book is called The Christian History of the American Revolution, Consider and Ponder. This is a part of the series that is put out by FACE, the Foundation for American Christian Education. I looked for my others. I had given them to my grandson, and I thought he brought them back, but I couldn't find them. But this one is a book worth the reading. It's quite long, but nonetheless worth the reading. And there's a discussion in here at one point, because this is the history of about the War for Independence. And the writer is dealing with all of the various facets. And part of it has to do with the dealing with the Iroquois Indians, because the Iroquois were so vital to the war that the Americans knew they needed the Iroquois on their side. The Iroquois were very, very powerful, and they were not hostile in the same way that the Apache or the Comanche or some of the other eastern tribes were. The Iroquois were actually organized into five nations, and they actually had a governmental structure, and they actually had asked for missionaries. So they wanted missionaries to come in, and at that point, there was a great distress because the Roman Catholic Church had sent some missionaries to bring them into Roman Catholicism, and the Iroquois were very impressed with all of the robes and all the trappings. That really impressed them. And so the Americans were very concerned, and in their policy, they decided that they needed to send two missionaries to each of the areas where the Iroquois were, and they needed to send two school teachers. Interesting to me is that when you read that and you go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 15, you see that's exactly what Asa did. When Israel was in so much trouble, they'd fallen so far from God, they had fallen away, and he did this. That's what he did, and it's like these people read the Bible and then copied it. This particular, I'm only going to read a short comment here. This particular comment, the subheading on it is Civil Effects of Christianity. And the opening comment says this: manners are the result of principles. The former naturally flow from and are regulated by the latter. Manners flow from the principles and are governed by those principles. Hence we find that barbarity and brutal vices, such are pernicious to mankind, have always been the portion of ignorant nations. Okay? If the white horse is education, and that's not the entirety of it, there's the other elements that come in to associate with that. But if this has been going on now for 150 years in our country, gradually separating us from a biblical-centered education to this behaviorism that is the center of it, and we read this and we say, barbarity and brutal vices such are pernicious to mankind have been the portion of ignorant nations. And we look at our nation and say, what do we have? We have barbarity. Everybody's out killing somebody. The Black Lives Matter out doing their destruction. I believe the Black Lives Matter. This is my own personal belief. I cannot verify it because that would be almost impossible. But I believe that group and some of the others which are doing all of the disruption of the Trump meetings and so forth are actually the civilian army that Obama said he was going to put together. When he went there, he needed a civilian army that was as well-trained and as highly paid, funded as our regular military. And so if you have 7 years of preparation, and now you get to this point, You follow the procedure of Hitler turning his brown shirts loose. You do the same thing, only he's never connected to it. He's always been able to keep himself separate. So we say, then what we're looking at, this barbarism or barbarity and brutal vices, such as are pernicious to mankind, are the portion of ignorant nations. Then we are an ignorant nation, obviously. He goes on to, speaking of the Iroquois, he says, in order to civilize the Iroquois, if I can jump for 1 second to another paragraph, in order to civilize the Iroquois, this is the description of the American Indian. It's not what you hear today. Indolence, idleness, and intemperance are inseparable concomitants of a savage life. So the Indians were ignorant. They were idle. They were intemperate. They did not govern their own selves. So in a state of intemperance, you just take whatever you want. You do whatever you want to do, and there is no rule to govern you. So she says, this is the condition. This is the actual condition of these, quote, uncivilized, unquote, Indians. So then she comes back and she says, it is necessary to begin with instructing them, especially in the principles of religion. Christianity is well adapted to this purpose. While it has a more immediate and important end in view, which is the salvation of mankind, which equally concerns all, it insensibly forms moral habits. So Christianity, she's saying, look, Christianity, as we look back now, what was going on here and what they were saying and writing at that time, these people saw it very clearly. Now, this is back in the 1700s. This is prior to, this is a little while prior to the actual beginning of the war between us and England, in which we sought to become an independent nation. So the effects, just in discussing about the Iroquois, we see that in mankind in general. And they were writing and they were talking about their fear of the Roman Catholic Church. And it said, the affection of the Indians will be alienated from us more and more, to which the pomp and ceremonies of the Romish religion, with which the savages are much captivated, will not a little contribute. The only method that is left to counteract this and prevent the bad consequences that must evidently attend it is to send Protestant missionaries among the Iroquois. Now, I don't know how you would send Protestant missionaries out in America today. I was sharing this with Debbie and Robin the other morning. I said, you're hard-pressed today to find Protestantism. The only place you're really going to find the Protestant is in a church like ours that is a Reformed, still holds to the Reformation, and understands what that Protestant word meant, which was a statement of opposition to a law that King Charles had made, saying those people that are already Reformed can stay that way, nobody else can become that way. And they protested it, and this name got hung on them. They were the Protestants, who said, no way, we have the liberty to preach the gospel, and the people are going to receive it, and the Reformation will grow. So where would you get Protestant missionaries? You would have to have the Lord raise up some people on the same order as he raised up Luther and Calvin and the crowd from that period, Wycliffe and Huss, as God raised them up. You'd have to have God raise up some people who were totally committed to sola scriptura. The Bible is our only rule of faith and practice. We're not going to accept anything else. We're going to go and teach this. And then God would have to send them into whatever places he would send them so that this message could be taken and taught. We have a problem right in our own church trying to propagate the gospel of Christ, trying to propagate the Reformation message, because for whatever reason, it seems like we can't communicate it to people and then draw them in to have them be taught. We're going to do a concert on the 29th. Jennifer's been working on the music for some time. I wish you could have heard those kids sing the other day. Wow. And we only had our six. We didn't have the Marinos. Jacob and Logan are gone for vacation, and so we had the other six were here, and they were going through it, and I mean, they were powerful. And the last song she does, I can't even tell you the title of it, but the one line that sticks in my mind is like a bride waiting for a groom. It's about the second coming of Christ, and it is something else. So on the 29th, we're going to do this concert, which is really our Easter concert. That because I ended up in the hospital and had some other things happen before, I was taken away from it and I couldn't work on it. So this is a missionary act. Our seminar in the summer is a missionary act. Our Bible school is a missionary act. And what we would like to do is we would like to have people bring people. And maybe they will hear something. The Lord will bring them in and the Holy Spirit will bring them so that they can hear something that they've never heard and hear the true gospel preached and be touched by it and become a part of this missionary activity that they talked about back here. So at that time also, one more reading from this. This is from a woman named Mercy Otis Warren. Mercy Otis Warren was the wife of one of the really important guys at that time, and she wrote a history on the War for Independence. I'm not going to read you the history. I only want to read this one portion. She says, the study of the human character. Now, I need to make a little caveat here. I need to give you a little warning. Some of her conclusions, I would not agree with the conclusions in the way she presents them, because she makes the point about, she's talking about a principle, the principle of righteousness, I presume, the principles of God, and she says they operate in every bosom, in the nature of man. It's implanted in the nature of man. Well, that would be go against, because that would not be a true position. It is not. It has to come by regeneration, when God the Holy Spirit does. But some of the points she makes are this: the study of the human character opens at once a beautiful and deformed picture of the soul. So we see a beautiful picture of the soul and a deformed picture of the soul. We there find a noble principle implanted in the nature of man that pants for distinction. This principle operates in every bosom, and when kept under the control of reason — she obviously had fallen into the snare of those people who began to worship reason — under the control of reason and the influence of humanity, it produces the most benevolent effects. This part, however, is correct. But when the checks of conscience are thrown aside, or the moral sense weakened by the sudden acquisition of wealth or power, humanity is obscured. Well, think of Barack Obama. He suddenly got all this wealth and power, and he went wild, and he's gone wild ever since he's been in power back in Illinois as a senator. He said, and she said, and if a favorable coincidence, being elected to high office is one, a coincidence of circumstance permits, this love of distinction often exhibits the most mortifying instances of profligacy, tyranny, and wanton exercise of arbitrary sway. Or in other words, they take over completely and they command people what to do, and people do not have a voice. In my concluding that education is the white horse, is the primary body of the white horse. If you understand the word education apart from the word school, most people think those two are the same. Education is school. Well, of course, school is education, but it is unfortunately miseducation today. But education starts when a child is born, and they start taking in information. As they start taking information, if you remember back to our class, to our counselor's class many years ago, I told you what they form is called norms and standards. And that child, as that child is growing, we see this in Candace. Look at Candace and Nicole. Look at Candace. Candace, you never know what person you're going to have day to day. Well, Candace, you don't know if she's going to be the sweet little girl, or she's going to be the sarcastic one, or she's just going to be, you never know. She looks the same, but there's something in her that is considered to be normal behavior, which she has learned from somebody. Now, her standards, thank God, because of Sandy's work and because of our work, Debbie and Robin take them to the home, the standards, we're beginning to get the standards, which are the determination of right and wrong, what is right and wrong, those are beginning to take root, so that she will very boldly sometimes tell somebody that they are, how wrong they are, and the reason is it's some biblical principle that they're in violation of. So she has both of those elements about her. As this child is starting to grow, today because of what's happened over the last 100 years, we've come to the point where the families today, in most cases, are not families. There is not a father who is the head. There's not a mother who is in submission to the father, and a father who's in submission to Christ. They don't understand that they are commanded by God to train their children in a certain way and to raise them up so that as they get older and older, they will be confirmed in that way, and then they will become teachers of it. So that what you do is you begin to produce this generation, a generation of children who become sound in the faith. Now, that is very hard work, especially where you take a child for a couple of hours a day, and you work for a couple hours a day putting in and putting in and putting in, and then they leave and go somewhere. And if they go somewhere where now they're hit with the exact opposite, what you're looking at is the formation of a double mind. And James says, a double-minded person is unstable in all their ways. So instead of coming to the maturity, the soundness of faith, they begin to get moved into this double-mindedness where what they can do then, they can come into school and they can be one thing. Then as soon as they leave and go to this other situation, they become that. So they don't have a real, real solid rule of faith and practice in them, which governs them all the time. They fit the way, wherever they are, and this is what they have learned through some fashion. This has been formed in them. Now, in the gradual movement of education from the biblical foundation that we had. If you would go back, I can't take time to read it all, but if you go back and read the 1600s, when they established the old deluder Satan law, for the very first public school in America, they called it the old deluder Satan law. They said, we don't want Satan to get an advantage of our kids, so we're going to start a school, and then we're going to have a schoolmaster who is going to teach them the things of God, just like the parents are doing at home. Now listen, clear back there, we still had sinners running around and people were not perfect and things were not done as perfectly as you would like them to be, but they were done a whole lot better than they are now. Okay, where did this start to slide? I'm going to give you from my book on education and I'm going to give you some dates and some things. 1762, a guy by the name of Jacques Rousseau. He published a thing called The Social Contract, and that book influenced the French Revolution. That's what brought the French Revolution about. In this book, Rousseau promoted child-centered, permissive education, in which a teacher should avoid strict discipline and tiresome lessons. Teachers should avoid strict discipline and tiresome lessons. Both Rousseau and Swiss educator Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi believed that the whole child should be educated by doing and that religion should not be a guiding principle in education. 1762. Religion should not be a guiding principle in education. So we're going to learn by doing, and that's where they about experience is the best teacher. That's kind of where that came from. 1832, Wilhelm Wundt, founder of the experimental psychology and the force behind its dissemination through Western world, came along. And to him, he said, nothing makes sense or is worth pursuing if it cannot be measured, quantified, and scientifically demonstrated. Okay. How do you quantify and scientifically demonstrate faith in Jesus Christ? How do you scientifically demonstrate the belief that God is God, that His law is His law, that we are to be subject to that law, because science will reject it and say, well, we can't scientifically prove, we cannot scientifically prove the existence of God. That's funny because in Romans it said they do it all the time. They look at nature and they say, wow. They don't call him God, they call him Mother Nature. Or they call it by some other term, but they actually see God. And in the 14th Psalm, when it says, the fool has said in his heart there is no God, in Charnock's Existence and Attributes of God, he makes the point that everybody believes in God. That's why I said the atheist is a liar. The atheist says he don't believe in God. He does. But he has a tendency to believe he is God. So his own opinions come about as what is right, and your opinions differing from him, you have to be wrong. So Wundt says, look, we're looking at science, which if you read the Humanist Manifesto, that's what it says in there. Now we're going to get to the original definition. Originally, education meant the bringing up as of a child, instruction, formation of manners. Education comprehends all that series of instruction and discipline which is intended to enlighten the understanding, correct the temper, form the manners and habits of youth, and fit them for youthfulness in their future stations, from Webster 1828. This is quoted. And the experimental psychologist, however, says education is the process of exposing the student to meaningful experiences so as to ensure desired reactions. You ever hear Pavlov? Pavlov had these dogs, and he got these dogs at the ringing of a bell. They would salivate, and they knew they wanted to eat. Got to the point he didn't even need to ring the bell. At the given time, the dogs reacted to this stimulus, and they were responded. How does that work today? We're racist. We use the word racist, and right away people are up in arms. So nobody can actually define racism. What is racism, after all? Well, let me come up with a definition. And so they throw up a definition that is suitable to their prejudice. So that we use that. Or she's a feminist. Or he's an anti-feminist. Or they are whatever, they're anti. They use these words, and the people have been so trained in this educational system that when they hear the words, they respond just like Pavlov's dogs. And that means they don't think. They are what you call a reactionary. So you can't go back. When Trump was walking out of a meeting, a woman reporter came up and grabbed him. His, I don't know what he is, campaign manager or whatever, I don't know. He went and pulled her away. He got arrested and charged. Of course, they finally acquitted him, said he didn't do this. So immediately the news media jumps on this, that this man is expressing violence toward women. Well, that's a part of the Pavlovian thought. That's the stimulus. How are you going to respond to that? So the next thing you know, everybody is angry. And what happened down in Missouri when the guy got shot? The grand jury took all of the evidence, weighed all of the evidence, and as a result of evidentiary procedure, found the officer innocent. What did they do? They burned the city. They destroyed property. They injured people. Why? Because Black Lives Matter. That's the stimulus. The people respond to the stimulus, okay? So Wundt, who introduced this thing using Pavlovian tactics in the educational system, they have now, over all these years, very successfully implanted this in what we call the norms and standards of these children, many generations of children, and they're still doing it today. The goal of Wundt, the goal was the development of schools which are oriented more towards socialization of the child than toward the development of intellect, and for the emergence of a society more and more blatantly devoted to the gratification of sensory desire at the expense of responsibility and achievement. What does this thing they call abortion do? These people engage in sexual activity, which is done not for nothing more than a moment's pleasure for them. The girl gets pregnant. Well, there's some responsibility here. I'm going to have a child. I'm going to have to raise this child. I'm going to have to do whatever. I'm going to have to go to work. Well, you avoid responsibility by killing the child. And now we've done that, 65, 70 million times since 1973. John Dewey, in 1896, John Dewey said the school should be social rather than individualist. So that we don't work. In our system, we work with individual children. They have strengths, they have weaknesses. You work to build their strength and heal their weakness. You work with them one-on-one. You don't compare. You don't say, you know, Billy is a really, really good reader. We've got some others who, if you listen to them read, you'll find out they don't look at all the words. They make up words. They got an idea of what the sentence is going to say, so that's what they say, and you have to stop them and say, no, let's go back and read. That's not good, because if they're reading the Bible, what's going to happen if they start skipping over all these words or making up words? So if you look at the word A-N-D and you read T-H-E, something's going on between the page and the eye, and you're not seeing A-N-D, you're seeing T-H-E. Or if you see T-H-E and what you read is A, what's going on here? Something's happening between page and eye that T-H-E, which is the, turns into A. Or some don't ever read endings. If the word is understanding, they will only read understand. If the word is a past tense word with an ed on the end, they don't read the past tense. They read the present tense. Well, that's not all of them. That's individuals. So that's why a couple of them don't like to have me listen to them read, because I'm always making them read it right. No, that's not what it said. Oh, you see them? They go like this. Go back and say, what's the ending on this word? Well, this is what Dewey said. In fact, Dewey actually went so far as to say that teaching children skills, to learn skills, was a very, very great sin. So in his 1898 essay, The Primary Education Fetish, in which Dewey wrote, he said, among other things, "There is a false education god whose idolaters are legion and whose cult influences the entire educational system." That's not Dewey. Samuel Blumenfeld commenting on Dewey. This is Dewey. "It is almost an unquestioned assumption of educational theory and practice, both that the first 3 years of a child's school life shall be mainly taken up with learning to read and write his own language," Dewey said. Dewey said, that is a great sin. He should not be dealing with reading and writing his own language during those first 3 years, which tells you why grammar's been removed from the school, and penmanship, no longer cursive. You can't do those things, all right? But what they're supposed to be doing is working on this behaviorism. And Dewey said, "The plea for the predominance of learning to read in early school life, because of the great importance attaching to literature, seems to me a perversion." So Dewey considered that a perversion, all right? All right, that's those guys. This book, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, written by a lady named Charlotte Thompson Iserbet, I don't know if I pronounce it right, but that's how it's spelled. She worked in the Department of Education under Ronald Reagan. And she worked in the department, I can't remember, tell you what it is now, I don't think I copied that part of it. She worked in the department, the portion of the Department of Education that is responsible for all of these evil changes that have gone on, starting with what they called outcomes-based education, outcomes-based education has gone through many changes, and now they're calling it critical thinking. So even ACE's fallen into the trap, and ACE's talking about how in their paces, it is very important that we develop the child's critical thinking skills. What are critical thinking skills? What does it mean to be a critic? You look at a piece of information and you criticize it. How do you criticize it? By placing the word of God against it. Well, if we're going to call this critical thinking, then what we're saying is, for me, you've got to have these children so trained in biblical truth that they can see the lie, they can recognize it very quickly, and then they will criticize it. And they'll put it aside, turn it away. This lady says, the department, I just have it here, the department is called the Office of Educational Research and Improvement. And she said, it is this office from which all the controversial national and international educational restructuring has emanated. She was gone from the country for 18 years, and when she came back to the country, she was shocked to see what had changed, and she worked in that office for 10 years. She said, when I returned to the United States, I realized that America's transition from a sovereign constitutional republic to a socialist democracy would not come about through warfare, but through the implementation and installation of the system in all areas of government, federal, state, and local. The brainwashing for acceptance of the system's control would take place in the school through indoctrination and the use of behavior modification, which comes under so many labels, the most recent labels being outcome-based education, Skinnerian master learning, and direct instruction. In the 1970s, this writer and many others waged war against values clarification, which was later renamed critical thinking, which regarding, and that means what you're supposed to do, in case you don't know, when a child, here's the way they view it. And a child at the age of five going into a kindergarten class in a government school is viewed as insane. They then take every value, whatever their values they hold, and they make that child question them. Well, who told you that? Well, my mom told me that. My dad told me. Well, you know, they don't have the latest information. They use some gimmick to get around it. So these little tiny children, they give them these books. Johnny has two moms or two dads, and this is supposed to be normal. So they start down at the age of three, at the age of five, and then they take 3 years. Their goal is to take 3 years and completely turn them from whatever moral values, whatever religious values, whatever they had going in those 3 years, they are completely conquered. And when they enter into fourth grade, they are these new people who think differently than what they did when they first came into school. She said in another on in the book, or this is just in the preface, she said, well, that was just the beginning. There was more to come. The new social studies textbook, World of Mankind, published by Follett. This book instructed the teacher how to instill humanistic, nothing is right, nothing is wrong values in K to three students. So by the time you're getting through that third grade, there is no right or wrong anymore. Now that goes to values clarification. In values clarification, they said, it might be wrong for me, but it's okay for you. All right, so because in your worldview, the way you view it, this is okay for you to do, but I don't, in mine, I don't. So I can't say you're wrong, I just have to say I don't do that. So because there is no right or wrong, okay? Then you can't pass judgment on homosexuals. You can't pass judgment on the abortionists or on the thieves or on anybody else. So she said, this is K to three. At the text suggestion, the teacher was encouraged to take little tots for walks in town, during which he would point out big houses and small houses. Asking the little tots who they thought lived in the houses, poor or rich, then he would ask, what do you think they eat in the big house? What do you think they eat in the little house? When I complained about this non-educational activity at a school board meeting, I was dismissed as a censor, and the press did its usual hatchet job on me as a misguided parent. And one of their favorite tricks is when a parent goes, they'll say, well, you're the only one complaining. You're the only parent complaining. Nobody else is complaining. And that makes a person kind of feel like they're maybe out of it. Now, she makes a distinction between educating and training. And what we're told by God is we're supposed to train them up. Well, that's what they're doing in the government schools. They're training them. And they train them to the point that they're fearful of objecting. Because if they object to something, it's going to come down on their head and they're going to be made to look like these fools or idiots or whatever. And so they will not stand against it. They simply fall into line and they marched the march. She said, my experience on the school board taught me that when it comes to modern education, the end justifies the means. Incidentally, that's a Jesuit point of view. The end justifies the means. And the current Pope is a Jesuit. So he can do anything he wants to accomplish whatever the goal is he's setting out to do. She said, our change agent superintendent was more at home with a lie than he was with the truth. Another milestone on my journey was an in-service training session called Innovations in Education. A retired teacher who understood what was happening in education paid for me to attend. This training program, developed by Professor Ronald Havelock of the University of Michigan and funded by the United States Office of Education, taught teachers and administrators how to sneak in controversial methods of teaching and innovative programs. These controversial, innovative programs included health education, sex education, drug and alcohol education, death education, critical thinking education, and so forth. She said, since then I found that an interesting thing. The controversial school programs are the only ones that have the word education attached to them. She said, I don't recall math education, reading education, history education, or science education. So this is a part of the gimmickry that they're doing. I got one more thing from my book. These are actual quotes. I owe this to Barbara Morris. So if you've never read Morris's book, Change Agent in the Schools, I don't even know if it's available anymore. But if you could I would think online, because almost everything is online. Change agents in the school, that they no longer, the colleges are no longer training teachers. They're training these change agents to take this, what is Dewey, take Dewey in them, and when they go into the school, they go in there to bring about these changes. Outcomes-based education, OBE is not new. It's been in the works for many years. Let's review some quotations that reveal the truth of the matter. This is from a paper called Schools for the 70s and Beyond, a call to action put out by the National Education Association, the Teachers Union. It says, teachers who conform to the traditional mode are out of place. They might find fulfillment as tap dance instructors or guards in maximum security prisons or proprietors of reducing salons or agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, but they damage teaching children and themselves by staying in the classroom. An article called the Feasibility Study, Behavioral Science Teacher Education Program, done at Michigan State University in 1969, they said development of a new kind of elementary school teacher who engages in teaching as a clinical practice and functions as a responsibility agent of social change. G.B. Chisholm, The Reestablishment of Peacetime Society, in the publication called Psychiatry. He says, the reinterpretation and eventually eradication of the concept of right and wrong, which has been the basis of child training, the substitution of intelligent and rational thinking for faith in the certainties of old people, these are the belated objectives of all effective psychotherapy. Would they not be legitimate objectives of original education? So they have to take the concept of right and wrong, it has to be eliminated, and their confidence in their parents, grandparents, these old people, destroyed. Kenneth Kenworthy, Social Studies for the 70s, said, in a sense, teachers are social engineers. In the same publication, he said, the basic personality patterns may have been formed before the children ever enter school. They can be changed, but the later that's postponed, the more difficult the process. So you get them in 3 years, K to three, which would be 4 years, I guess, K to three. Larry Palmatier, How Teachers Can Innovate and Still Keep Their Jobs, he said, keep the door closed. The successful teacher innovates quietly and without fanfare. Use a special vocabulary. Avoid change, fun, new, sensitivity, students' rights, students' choice. Publicly stress instead mastering basics, students' responsibility, hard work, respect, traditional values, proven discipline, and results. He said, enlist the parent, enlist the students in your game plan. make a rule and gain students' agreement that they will not ask other teachers why they don't do what you're doing. Carry a book around. Potential blockers will give you more latitude to operate if you appear to know what you're doing. Name your program as early as you feel you can. Use titles which will not alienate the general public. See, it's all of it is like undercover. We're doing this thing that's going on. And finally, from the March 22, 1974 newsletter of the Prince George's County in Maryland County Educators Association, teachers are ordered to oppose SB 196, the parental rights for public school children. Tell legislators that this legislation is not needed. It may render schools ineffective as change agents since it would place all curriculum in the hands of the parents. And lastly, the more visible change is, the more threatening it becomes and the more it will be resented. Couch the language of change in the language of the status quo. Emphasize the new program's similarity to familiar programs. Use the stated objectives of the status quo. They're almost broad enough to encompass innovation. Unobtrusively change one unit. The innovation, if successful, will spread. And that's from Michelle Smith, a desegregationist looks at the change process. It was in a publication called Social Change, and that was in 77. So when did the White Horse Rider come out? John looks and he said, when the first seal was opened, I saw this white horse, this rider come out, conquering and to conquer. With regard to us, our country, and so forth, when do we begin to see it? Well, we go back and look at it. We say, this was not recent. This is a very slow process. I remember Dave Gibbs one time teaching on the word revolution. He said, it's improper to call the war for independence a revolution because a revolution occurs very slowly. He said, that occurred rather rapidly. So a revolution takes a long time. It's like revolving around the sun, I guess, or something. It takes a long time. Well, here's our situation. Psalm 145. The fourth verse, but I'm going to read the first four. This is where we are. I will extol thee, my God, O King, and I will bless thy name forever and ever. Every day will I bless thee, and I will praise thy name forever and ever. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise thy works to another and shall declare thy mighty acts. So the way I look at it is we are so far in the hole, we're talking about at least a generation. Well, where are we going to get the people? Somewhere God has to open the door some way, somehow, I don't know, to get the people to begin to train the people to train the people. So that somewhere, because the parents are sucked into this thing so badly, I think even the ones we have, some of them look at us as the odd guys. We're like the oddballs. Remember Ralph, what was Ralph's last name?
Rice.
Yeah, Ralph Rice. He said he had a parent come up and say, Bible, 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 Bible. All you people think is Bible. What's wrong with you? And Ralph looked back and said, well, actually, that's what's right with us. Bible, Bible, Bible. And that's sort of where we are. But this is the burden that God has given us. So that's what we do in hope. You work in hope that at least these, we have eight. If all eight of these would become committed to Christ, they'd become a dynamic force. Because they're not going to buy what the world's selling them. Okay, I'm going to quit.